KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Way, way back, my mother gave me one of those thick Reader's Digest books on home repair, and it was the best thing. I could refer to that and fix anything.
It's a secret program that is hard to get information about, and yet the court is seeming to require plaintiffs to get that absolute certainty before they can challenge the constitutionality of the surveillance.
The Seattle Supersonics are the new world champions, and I now want to present the world trophy to them, which they can keep permanently, and be careful of it because it's gold.
Ah, you can see that gold 79 championship trophy at the Museum of History and Industry. We're going to take a little tour of Sonic's memorabilia later this hour. We also heard from Roger Ferrist, who's our guest, and about the constitutionality of the FISA Amendment Act. From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scher. The U.S. Supreme Court has turned back a challenge to expanded surveillance by the federal government. In a 5-4 ruling, the court has ruled that a group of plaintiffs have no standing to challenge the 2008 FISA Amendments Act, the FAA. Those plaintiffs included Amnesty International, the American Civil Liberties Union, journalists, and attorneys who were defending clients interned at Guantanamo Bay. So what does the high court ruling really mean? We turn now to Ryan Gallagher. He reports on surveillance, national security, and privacy for Slate's Future Tense blog. He's also a Future Tense Fellow at the New America Foundation. And Ryan joins us this morning from London. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Well, first off, I was hoping that you could explain what this law is that was challenged.
Yeah, well, the reason it's so contentious is there's an amendment that was made to FISA in 2008, which effectively retrospectively legalized what was known as the Bush warrantless wiretapping program that was instituted after 9/11. And what this law basically allows is for the spy agency, the NSA, the National Security Agency, to intercept large quantities of communications that pass from the United States to foreign countries, so countries like Pakistan or Yemen, for example. And why these groups are concerned about this law and why they've tried to challenge it is because they believe that their phone calls, their international emails and other communications can be intercepted, and so that's a concern for those groups.
And Justice Samuel Alito, who wrote the majority opinion, said that essentially they didn't agree with the plaintiffs because these plaintiffs could not prove that their communications had already been intercepted, that they were challenging the law based on the future possibility that they could be surveilled.
Yeah, that was the core sort of essence of this ruling. The Supreme Court has basically said, because the plaintiffs can't prove conclusively that they are subject to the surveillance, that therefore they have no standing. So it's actually a really kind of bizarre reasoning, because the program in itself is very secret. So, it's very difficult to prove an evidence conclusively that you have been subject to the surveillance. So you can't actually get to the point where you can ever challenge it in the first place, even if you speculatively believe that you could, kind of plausibly be subjected to the surveillance. So it's a strange reasoning. But it was split as well. We should
right.
sort of emphasize that it was split 5-4, the decision. So it wasn't absolutely, there was some dissenting opinion in there with some of the Supreme Court justices.
One thing that Justice Alito also wrote was that there was a secret court that's monitoring the legalities of surveillance. But obviously the court is secret, but what do we know about this body?
Yeah, well, they call it the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and they basically take... when the National Security Agency has a program that it wants to initiate a surveillance operation of some kind, they will submit an order that explains what that's going to do, and the judges in this secret court take a look at it and they basically just sign it off. And I think they release sort of statistics yearly on an annual basis, and very rarely do they ever deny one of these orders. Usually they approve all of them. But we don't actually ever get to see what's contained in the orders. So again, that adds to the secrecy around it. Although there is a court there and there is some element of oversight through the Fifth Court and also through the Director of National Intelligence, for example, we don't actually get to hear about, well, what do these orders contain? What sorts of information is in there? What exactly is this program doing? I think that sort of just adds to the broader concerns around what's going on.
Does this particular Supreme Court ruling spell the end of any kind of challenges to the law?
No, I don't think it does. The ruling was specific in that it said the holding in this case by no means insulates FISA from further judicial review. I think that there's also another ongoing case which is called Juul versus NSA, and that's the Electronic Frontier Foundation, another civil rights group which is challenging some of these surveillance efforts. And that case is ongoing, I believe, in the Federal District Court in San Francisco. So I think, I mean, you will see some other challenges to this this surveillance, but the Supreme Court judgment yesterday was extremely significant because it has established a kind of precedent that forces people to you know, produce evidence that they have been subjected to secret surveillance. But obviously, as we've discussed, that's extremely difficult to prove, and so there's now a precedent on that.
Right. Sounds like a catch-22. You can't prove that you were surveilled because it's secret, but so
exactly,
that you can't challenge it. Is it conceivable, I don't know possible, but conceivable that the U.S. Congress could repeal or further amend the law to protect the citizenry?
Yeah, well, at the end of last year, just before Christmas, there were efforts to, add in various new amendments to this law that will bring in new oversight and more transparency. And I think that probably that's what we're going to see now. There's going to be more efforts to bring in these new amendments. Although at the time, before the law was renewed just before Christmas for another 5 years until 2017, they had no time, they claimed, to put in the new amendments. But there are lawmakers in the Senate who are very strong on this and who've been moving to bring in new clauses that will sort of allow for more transparency. And I think that's probably the direction that it's going to go in the future.
Do you have any sense, Ryan, of the timetable for that second suit that the Electronic Frontier Foundation has going through the courts now?
I'm not sure exactly what stage it's at now, but I think the it was heard in December of last year, and I think it's still ongoing. So I believe that, maybe even within the next few months, certainly I would expect at some point this year there will be movement on that. But I must say personally that I don't think that you'll see anything much different in that ruling when it finally is made, because the trend has been on almost everything to do with this, that sort of secrecy prevails, and the NSA seem to always win on that basis. I'm not sure we'll see any groundbreaking revelations coming out of the San Francisco case either.
Ryan, thanks so much for taking time to be with us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
Ryan Gallagher reports on surveillance, national security, and privacy for Slate's Future Tense blog. He's also a Future Tense Fellow at the New America Foundation. He joined us from London. Just to recap, the U.S. Supreme Court has turned back a challenge to expanded surveillance by the federal government in the 5-4 ruling. The court ruled that a group of plaintiffs had no standing to challenge the 2008 FISA Amendments Act, the FAA. This is Weekday.
.914 Historic Seattle Sonics memorabilia in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from North Seattle Community College, committed to improving lives through education, with associate and transfer degrees and career training, including aviation electronics, healthcare, and more. Online and on-campus classes. Enrolling now for spring quarter. Information at northseattle.edu.
44 degrees, mostly cloudy in Seattle. Forecast calls for clouds all day and an afternoon high of 49. Whether you've got moss on your roof, birds in your chimney, or bats in your belfry, you might need some help getting your place in shape. Well, you're in luck. Home repair expert Roger Ferris is going to be here to help you out in 15 minutes.
So welcome to the game. Ladies and gentlemen, shout the name. Seattle Supersonics.
Oh yeah, that was the olden days. We had a team. Basketball fans in Seattle do have a lot to be excited about these days. The NBA Board of Governors is going to vote April 18th on the sale of the Sacramento Kings to an investor group led by Chris Hansen. And Hansen plans to move that team to Seattle, and the team would play in a brand new arena. And last week, King County Superior Court judge knocked down one challenge to the arena construction. So if the sale goes through, Chris Hansen says he would revive the name Supersonics, the green and gold colors, and the history of our old basketball team. Hansen would also get all of the collected memorabilia of the old team. The treasures are currently owned by Oklahoma City businessman Clay Bennett. You can all be booing and hissing at home. But those treasures did not go to Oklahoma. They're in Seattle. And our own KOW's Deborah Wong, I think, got the first peek at them. Of anybody. And so that's Mike Six, Bernard. Mike Six? Okay.
Do we have a mic?
We have a mic now.
We are on. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. It's been at Mohai, this huge collection of hundreds and hundreds of items, and it's not a well-known fact. They've been on metal shelves in this giant storage facility down in Georgetown in South Seattle, and various pieces of it have come out here and there, but no one has ever gotten a sort of a full preview of what's down there.
Well, so Clay Bennett bought the team, but he didn't get the stuff. You know, what's up?
What happened? So do you remember when he bought the team, a year after he bought the team, in 2007, he announced that he would be moving the team to Oklahoma City. Surprise.
Right, right.
And at that time, the city of Seattle, you may remember, filed a lawsuit.
Yes, they do.
To keep the team here. And the idea was they had a lease at Key Arena that was to go to 2010. So the city was trying to keep them to that lease.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened is we went through a trial. We had a whole trial. The judge was about to rule on the case. And then all of a sudden, the two parties came out and announced that they were settling it. Now, obviously, Seattle didn't win because the Suns
ended up moving, as
we all know. We all know how it ended up. But the consolation prize was the city got $45 million and a couple of other things. The city got an agreement from Clay Bennett and his group that they would not use the Sonics name or colors in Oklahoma City, which they probably didn't intend to do anyway.
Right.
The other thing that they got was that all of the intellectual property, the memorabilia, would stay in Seattle pending the arrival of a new NBA team.
Wow.
Yeah.
That seems a little bit crazy. So all this stuff, this is decades of history. What kind of stuff are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of items. The most important item, the one item that probably every Sonics fan would recognize is the 1979 championship trophy. That was from the 78-79 season when the Sonics became the first ever professional sports franchise to win a championship in the city.
And I just have to ask, you got to see this thing.
Well, that trophy is on display at Mohai. It's actually one of the... You could see it. If you go down to the new Museum of History and Industry, which is on South Lake Union, it's brand new, in the old Naval Armory. They've done it up really beautifully. That's one of the couple of things in this collection that you will be able to see.
Well, so what? 79, we won a championship. Why is it such a big deal?
Well, it was the first professional sports championship in the city. It was the first time that Seattle had ever brought home a championship. And Leonard Garfield, who's the executive director of Mohai, says it was kind of the times back then that made it such a big deal.
you know, it was incredible for the city because it, you know, 79 wasn't the best of times in Seattle. We had come through those dark days of the Boeing bust. We were really sort of still struggling in some ways, and this was a chance for everybody to come together. And I think everybody did. The team members were local heroes. Everybody was thrilled with the success of the team, and we had gotten so close the year before, and then we won in 79. And getting that trophy and bringing it back to Seattle and the parades and the celebrations, it still is remembered as the high mark for people who are sports fans in Seattle.
It's probably because it's the only championship that any Seattle team has ever won except for the University of Washington Huskies.
And the WNBA.
The WNBA was very exciting. In the rain, there was a parade. I know you're not a huge basketball fan, but you did get to go. You mentioned all this stuff other than this trophy is down in some, is it some secret warehouse?
It seems like it. So Mohai has the bulk of its collection in a storage facility down in Georgetown.
Wow.
So they have hundreds of, like 100,000 items down in Georgetown, and a couple thousand of them are in the museum, but most of them are down in Georgetown. And you go in, it's a little kind of very nondescript looking office building. Everything is under lock and key. It's a big, huge climate controlled facility. And, you know, they had to put on white gloves, actually not white gloves, but plastic gloves before they took all these things out. They're in big boxes. They're on metal shelves that are sort of piled up to the ceiling. There were the banners, the championship banners that used to hang from the rafters of the old Key Arena and the old Kingdom. They're kind of carefully folded up and wrapped in plastic. There's the two Western Conference trophies that the Sonics won from 78 and 79. There are all of the retired jerseys. There's six retired jerseys, including Jack Sikma's, who was number 43, Nate McMillan, number 10, Lenny Wilkins, 19, and downtown Freddie Brown, number 32. There's basketballs. There's a ton of photographs and old videotapes and old like film tapes.
Wow.
Super 16 film game reels from the early 1970s and a ton of practice uniforms and shoes and things like that.
It sounds random. Was there anything that just jumped out at you?
Well, what was kind of strange about it is it included the really important stuff that I mentioned, you know, the trophies and things. But it also included this really strange collection of kind of marketing materials, things like, you know, placemats from some McDonald's giveaway that they did and coloring books and posters. And you know, I assume that like every single marketing campaign that they had to retain one or two pieces of it. And there were like really kind of odd souvenirs. And my favorite was this, you know, Slick Watts was a famous player in the Sonics. And they have this little Russian nesting doll, you know, where you open one and there's like another.
It was basketball players?
It was just Slick Watts, apparently. It was all in the original packaging, so we didn't open it up. But I assume it was Slick Watts all the way down through.
So did the Sonics have a curator? I mean, who determined what got saved?
Well, that's the big mystery. So according to this settlement agreement that the city of Seattle signed with Clay Bennett, there would be an agreement as to what artifacts were passed into this collection. But nobody that I spoke to, including the attorneys from the city, I spoke with Mayor Nichols and asked him how this came about. Nobody seems to know exactly how this collection came about, aside from the fact that one of the people who was there when they took possession of the artifacts said they showed up at the Sonics practice facility and people were literally taking things off of walls and sort of bundling up huge packages of jerseys and things. And the folks from Mohai said, you know, we can't take all of this stuff. So they really just kind of took a representative portion of everything and then packed it all away.
As curators, as official curators, they curated what was there.
Right. But although since it's not their technically their collection, it still belongs to the Oklahoma City Group. They really couldn't take that many liberties with the collection. They pretty much had to take what they were offered.
So, Deb, how is it that I mean, some of it, very little of it is at Mohai. How is it that you got to go into this warehouse?
Well, Mohai, you know, Mohai will open up its collection to whoever asks to see it. That's part of their kind of community service. And my sense is that nobody has really asked before. I mean, people have asked to see specific things and they have a catalog of, you know, of these hundreds of articles that they'll send you. So people have asked to see, you know, specific things, but I guess nobody's asked. And I had to get permission from Clay Bennett and the Oklahoma Thunder and they did. I mean, they gave it to us, so it was not a problem.
But it doesn't hurt them for you to see the collection, I assume.
I suppose there's kind of, you know, at the time is right, maybe. You know, it seems like, you know, we may be getting a basketball team. People are getting more excited about it. It certainly doesn't hurt them.
So right now, officially, they own it, but we keep it. What happens if Chris Hansen's bid for the Sacramento Kings is successful?
Well, in the agreement, it says that the memorabilia will be available to a new basketball team if they choose to take it. So the assumption is that Chris Hansen wants to name the new team. The Sonics wants to revive mm-hmm. the legacy and the history of the team. Therefore, I assume that it would go to Chris Hansen. Now, his ownership team will not say a thing about this. I asked them if they would comment on the memorabilia. They will not talk about it at all, I assume, because so much is in play right now. The NBA also will not talk about this. And the Oklahoma City Group will not talk about this. So there's probably too much going on at the moment for them to sort of entertain questions about memorabilia.
Right. I guess so. So right now, Mohai keeps it.
Mohai keeps it until otherwise notified. And they say that if a new team does come to Seattle, they will be happy to sort of break this stuff out and show more of it to the public. And here's Leonard Garfield again.
Are you kidding? If a basketball team comes to Seattle, first of all, we are the home of all the great memorabilia of the Sonics. And if a basketball team returns to Seattle, we will be celebrating that in a big way and making more of that available to the public, because it's really part of our heritage and it really is part of the new team's history as well.
So you're going to bring it out of the warehouse?
We're going to bring it out of the vaults, out of the warehouse, so everybody can enjoy it.
Well, listeners, you get a little sneak peek. Is that correct,
Deb? Yeah, that's probably. I saw a portion of all of the items, but we're going to have a more complete story about this tomorrow, and there's stuff on the web already.
Right. Deb has photos, and I mean, not the entire collection.
No.
But you get a chance to look at some of it, and I guess now we just wait till April the 18th.
To see what happens. Absolutely.
KOW's own Deb Wong, the first reporter to look at all this cache of Sonics memorabilia. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
Basketball is my favorite sport. I like the way to dribble up and down the court. Just like I'm the king on the microphone. So is Dr. J and Moses Malone. I like slam dunks and taking it to the hoop. My favorite play is the alley. Ooh, I like the pick and roll. I like the give and go. Cause it's basketball. Or Mr. Curtis Blow.
Mr. Curtis Blow there on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Heading into spring soonish, it's time to start working on those long overdue home repair projects. Got a problem that's stumping you or need some advice? Ask the expert in a minute.
Says Rod Molly to James. That's a fine motorbike.
Richard Thompson constantly reimagines his songs.
If you are a songwriter, you keep revisiting your songs all the time. And as I'm singing the songs, I get different pictures. You know, every night the little movie is a little different.
A performance chat with Richard Thompson later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Is a ring for your right hand.
Later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, today from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from the lawyers and staff of Stoll Reeves. The Stoll Reeves Law Firm provides businesses in all stages of growth with a broad range of legal services from its offices in Washington and throughout the Western U.S. More information is available at stoel.com.
Forty-six degrees in Seattle under a mostly cloudy sky. Forecast calls for clouds through the day, afternoon high of 49. Tonight, cloudy with rain after midnight and a low of 41. Tomorrow, Thursday, breezy with rain at times and a high of 51. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:28. A bit later this hour, we're going to take a brief mental vacation and spend a moment listening to birdsong in Nicaragua. That's 30 minutes away.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. With spring almost around the corner, it's time to think about doing a little home maintenance. You know, those repairs that you said that you were going to get to once the weather was better. Well, at least it's light out, if not totally spring. And home repair guru Roger Ferris joins us once again, and he's here to give you a little help, a little direction with some of those deferred maintenance projects. Roger's director emeritus of the Finney Neighborhood Center's Well Home Program, works on hazard mitigation for FEMA, and joins us regularly to talk about whatever you might be thinking about. And if you've got a question, this is the man to answer it. 206-543-5869, 206-543-KUOW, or you can email us weekday at KUOW.org. So what are you working on these days, or is your home done, Roger?
It's never done, but I'm just back from Alaska, where I had some more adventures with FEMA, but where learned an interesting lesson, which is that we're very, very lucky here that basically the do-gooders have won the battle to keep Seattle as a livable place. There are competing factions, and so I learned when I was up there about what people who demand individual freedom in excess can do to a city, to a village, to a community. And you know, the specific example that was impressive in the wintertime was smoke from burning wood, coal, and trash.
Well, I know that's bad for the air. Is it bad for the buildings?
Well, it's extremely bad for the people who breathe the air.
Sure.
And it turned out that in the Freedom Belt, which is up there near Fairbanks and North Pole.
Is that an official name of a place?
That's what they call the folks who live in that area. And they get a little extreme in their freedom to burn whatever they want, whenever they want. And they had air quality issues that were much worse than Beijing, China, even though they have, you know, around 100,000 people and you know, about four times worse than Los Angeles, you know, 48 days of seriously dangerous air quality so far this winter, whereas they had about 13 days for an entire year in Los Angeles. So, you know, people can get a little carried away with the freedom to do whatever they want at the expense of their neighbors.
That wasn't the reason that you'd gone up there, though,
air
quality.
It was just an incidental thing that I learned more about when I was there. Some folks there regularly vote to not have any regulations on, you know, reasonable things like, well, if you're going to burn wood, make sure it's dry, or, you know, have a certified stove and dry wood or something like that. Instead, they sometimes burn creosote timbers, trash, dead animals, coal, lots of coal, or anything else that they feel like burning because there are no rules.
I was going to say that you were talking about air pollution, but I would imagine burning creosote timbers can't be good for a chimney or a stove.
No, and it's just horrible for the neighbors who have to breathe
right.
It as well. But, you know, this is the way to kill your neighborhood. In fact, one neighborhood up there is known as the Rectangle of Death, and that's not good for resale value.
No, I shouldn't laugh, but no, that's a horrible name. Roger Ferris is with us once again, he's talking about air quality right now, but we're talking about home repair, and our phone number is 206-543-5869. Hi, Cindy in West Seattle. You're on the air with Roger.
Hello, Roger.
Good morning.
In order to make the conversation easier, I think I need to ask the name of a part. And then I can explain the problem, because I don't really know what the gizmo inside the toilet that loses its seal, and then you have to, like, jiggle the handle all the time so that it stops running, like, for 3 and 4 and 5 hours.
Right. Yeah, that sounds very familiar. You know, what I found with the little mechanism adjustment and repair in a toilet is that if you're persistent at fiddling with the different things that need adjustment or replacement, you will prevail. But sometimes it takes more than one trip to the hardware store to, because sometimes it turns out you're working on the wrong part. Now, the most typical thing is that the little flapper at the bottom of the tank is no longer doing its job properly. And so it just runs and runs because it's not sealing. And sometimes that's because it's old and mushy and worn out and just needs to be replaced. More often it's because it's out of alignment. It's been sort of jerked a little bit to the side and it can be just kind of readjusted. But it's a matter of getting to know the inside of your toilet tank.
Well, my question question is actually not that gizmo, really.
Oh.
I would like to know what the break-even point is on purchasing one of these new dual-flush toilets.
Oh, sure. Well, it depends. If you have an old toilet that's using way too much water, then my recommendation is definitely go ahead and get a modern toilet that is water-saving, you know, 1.6 gallon, and be sure that you invest in one that's high enough quality so that it flushes well, because, you know, the cheap ones just don't do the job, and you end up flushing twice or three times. But a good quality one will do the job and save water and will just function beautifully. And so, you know, talk to the dealers about why some of them are more expensive than others, and then buy the better one. It's really important that you get a good one.
So 1.6 is the starting point.
Yes, that's the standard now, maximum water usage for a toilet in this state.
But I think the toilet's 10 years old that we'd be replacing.
Right. Well, the 1.6 standard has been around for a while, but it could be that your toilet is just fine, but the mechanism is questionable. I think if you look inside the tank, you'll see the gallon rating, which should say 1.6 gallon.
Excellent. Okay, well, I have some starting information.
Thanks for your call, Cindy. We're talking to Roger Ferris here on KUOW, and here's a familiar problem. Mary writes, where do you start and who do you call when you have a small leak that shows on your basement floor, not every year, but maybe every other year? We don't want to install a French drain or spend a lot of money if we don't need to. However, we can't proceed with a remodel till we get to the root of this problem.
Right. If the remodel involves like a finished floor down there, you don't want any water at all.
No.
Well, you know, Marcy's been through this.
Yes, indeed.
with an elaborate exterior perimeter trench system and piping, and it works great. But it is very disruptive because you tend to have porches, bushes, trees, and, you know, all kinds of gardens that you're digging up. So I can understand your reluctance to go in that direction for a tiny little problem. The usual fix is, at least the place to start, is to make sure that your downspout drainage is either diverted far from the house and downhill away from the house, or it's going into some kind of system that doesn't have any cracks or leaks, because the downspout drainage is the typical problem, the main issue. And of course, if the gutters are all clogged up with leaves and pine needles, then the downspout drainage isn't going to be functioning anyway. You have lots of water landing right next to the foundation, which finds its way down under the slab in the basement and eventually shows up somewhere. So, you know, keep after the gutter downspout issues and you'll probably solve the problem. You know, more than 85% of the problems are directly related to all that roof catchment being discharged too close to the house.
This is not the typical winter. Anyway, it's been drier than average this winter. So my guess is that they didn't have too much water in that basement this year.
Right.
But you never know what next winter has in store.
And then, you know, if none of those things work and you occasionally still get water, then one thing that's sort of a compromise is to figure out where it might work to put in a sump pump and, you know, break through the slab, which is usually quite easy to do, and get the real setup with the lid that's flush with the floor and a good quality pump that's down below, and it's surrounded, the whole unit is surrounded by a plastic kind of cylinder with holes in it and gravel around that, so that if there is any groundwater under the slab, it migrates toward this little sump pit and it gets pumped up and goes through a check valve and then into your drain system, so that basically, the water is kept at bay, and that works pretty well. It's a nice sort of backup in case you ever have a basement flood. Then there's a system down there that can handle it. But that's actually a pretty good solution for the minor problem.
Good luck, Mary. Our phone number with Roger Ferris, 206-543-5869, or toll-free, 1-800-289-5869. Hi, Ken in Bremerton. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Greetings.
Good greetings. You're on the air.
Thanks. Roger, I had a question. It seems that I've never really had much of a problem with moss before. This is a home maintenance question. But this year, it's just all over the place. The roof has been covered in it. I've used I tried the chemical, one of the chemical products on the roof. It killed the moss, but it's pretty tenacious up there. And also on the concrete around the house, it was like a moss farm around the house. And this has never happened before in any previous years I can recall. I used boiling water, which I heard was kind of a good way to do it. It doesn't have any kind of negative impact in terms of chemical contamination, et cetera. And it killed the moss, but the stuff is still kind of there, and I ended
right.
up scraping it off with a shovel and then taking it off with a wire brush. It was really labor-intensive. And then I threw down some baking soda, which I heard was good because it creates an alkaline base that the moss doesn't find attractive. I just wanted to see what your thoughts were on moss control, particularly this year.
I like the baking soda experiment or baking powder, and I want to try that someday because, you know, that just appeals to me. But just coincidentally, I got notified by my homeowner's insurance company that they would like me to remove the little bit of moss that I had on part of the roof and all of the moss in my driveway, which is sloping, and I guess they saw it as a liability. So the fellow had actually done a kind of a drive-by and noted these things. And, you know, I'd always talked about how the problem with moss is that insurance companies don't like it. Mm. And sure enough, I got notified. And so I had to deal with this recently. I used a pressure washer on the driveway and got very wet and kind of muddy, but got it done. And that now the driveway looks brand new. For the roof, I went up there with my safety rope, and I was careful to tie the rope to places where it would really be secure. And I had to move it from time to time to get to different parts of the roof. But I successfully got rid of all of the moss with my garden hose and a little nozzle. And so I blasted it off, which is a little bit hard on the surface of the, in my case, the asphalt composition and the little granules of sand that's built into that. But it did it. I got it all off. And, you know, first I disconnected my downspout so that the moss wouldn't go down the drains. But anyway, I cleaned up everything, had to hose off the house, had to hose off the neighbor's house on both sides because it made a mess doing all this. But I got it done. It's a little hazardous, but that... Now, a neighbor once hired a contractor who brought out an air wand, very high pressure, had a big trailer out on the street with a long hose and blasted it off with air pressure.
Wow.
And so that might be more gentle on the roof surface, but that was a specialty contractor who had that equipment. I didn't have it, and so I used water, and it did the job. Wasted a lot of water. My water bill is going to be interesting next month.
But either way, this some kind of labor isn't involved. I mean, Ken's going to have to do something, whether it's scrubbing or blasting.
Because you can kill it with the chemicals, but it doesn't really go away. It just kind of sits there and then forms a nice base for the next crop. So, because, you know, it doesn't really do much harm unless you have wood shingles, because the roots don't go deep into the material. But it sits there and... The insurance companies regard it as a sign of deferred maintenance, and they don't like it.
Does that help you, Ken?
Problems too is it gets underneath each shingle and kind of pushes the shingle up and allows water possibly to get in there.
True. That's out. I guess that's another reason why they don't like it, because it does sort of lift the shingles slightly. And blasting it with water lifts the shingles slightly, I noticed, but I did it anyway because... basically, I was told I had to.
Right.
And I couldn't figure out any other way to get it off efficiently. It actually worked quite well with my little nozzle.
Good luck with that, Ken. Moss.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at my driveway, hoping my insurance agent doesn't drive by.
Yeah.
Roger Ferris is with us, and we have this nice email from JM. First, I still have my Reader's Digest complete guide to home repair, writes. But more importantly, and several other people have this question, how do you prioritize maintenance projects? I need another intake vent for my new heater. It's drawing in air from every 70-year-old window in the house. I also need new windows, windowsills painted, a new paint job, insulation. Occasionally, the bathtub drains a bit of water onto the floor because of an odd drain system. That would require a new bathroom floor and a remodel. What's first? Also, the detached garage would be usable if it had electricity and an access door.
Yeah.
So where do you start?
I know it is tough, and you can't just do nothing. Some of these things, if you ignore them, the problems really get bad, like the windowsills that need paint. You know, if they get too badly weathered and cracked, then water gets in and they start to rot. Water gets into the walls, and you know, bad things can happen. So you kind of have to pick, you know. And it depends a little bit on what kind of day it is. You know, if it's perfect weather for painting those windowsills, you might do a little scraping and capture the chips, prime and paint. You know, for the window replacement, I always remember the Hawaii factor, which is, you know, don't replace the windows, but, you know, every so often shut down your house in the winter and go to Hawaii for a while. And, you know, spend the money on that.
And you're going to fund that, right?
And well, you save the energy because your house is kind of, you know, minimally heated while you're gone.
So what you're saving, you can use for airfare to Hawaii? Is that what you're saying?
That's kind of the Hawaii factor. There's the R factor and the U factor for, you know, energy efficient windows. But the H factor is Hawaii.
Hawaii, I'm all for that. Roger Ferris is with us on KUOW, and Babs is in Bellevue. Hi, Babs.
Hi. I love your H factor.
Yeah. You're ready to go, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. The reason I'm calling is I have a hot water tank that was installed, I would say, about 5-6 years ago. I know they last about 10 years.
Right.
A year after it was installed, I had the flooring replaced. And ever since the flooring was replaced, there is a very slow leak of about half a cup a month of water, and I just put a little plastic cup underneath, and when I'm out of town, I have friends come like every 10 days to get rid of the water.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, I mentioned it to the person who installed it, and he said, oh, those, you know, floor guys. And then that was the end of it. So I've been putting up with this now, I would say four or five years at least.
Right.
Do I have something to worry about?
Well, you know, what's funny about that is I had a similar thing recently, and I thought, oh, no, my tank, you know, it's really old. It's starting to leak. But before pulling it out and putting in a new tank, I looked really closely, and I realized, wait a minute, this water is coming from a fitting that probably got bumped when there were kids and dogs in the house, and they were kind of being pretty wild down there in the basement, chasing each other around. And, you know, I could kind of figure it out. But, yeah, I think the whole tank got bumped pretty hard. And anyway, there was a leaking fitting, and it was a matter of getting out a couple of wrenches and tightening that fitting. And I no longer had a puddle on the floor. So before you do anything too drastic, look very closely. I'm suspecting that it might be your little drain valve at the bottom. Those things are, you know, sometimes just need to be tightened a little bit. And it's certainly worth, you know, looking very closely to try to sort out where this leak is coming from.
Well, I do have a cup right underneath that valve. The tank sits on one of those big deep dishes.
Right.
So that's how I first noticed it. There'd be water.
Yep.
And now I've got a little plastic cup that fits perfectly that I can take out every, you know, 10 or so days.
Yeah.
And it's coming from that gold, whatever, fitting.
That's it. So I think your tank is fine. You just need to tighten that valve. And it might just be the handle itself, or it could be the little packing nut that's maybe not quite as accessible behind that. But I think a little fiddling around with that might very well do the trick.
Okay.
Whenever I'm about to fiddle with plumbing, though, I usually try to remember to shut off the pressure first. There should be a shutoff valve above the hot water heater where the cold water goes in. So if you turn that off, at least you won't have as much pressure if you have some kind of spectacular failure with your fiddling with your pipes or your valve. It won't be under the full water pressure if you do have, you know, if you make a mistake.
Good luck, Babs. Thanks for your call. We're talking to Roger Ferris here on KUOW, and the number is 543-5869. A couple of roof comments. Mary says zinc and baking soda keep moss off the roof a very long time. Be careful when you power wash your roof. Mary Jo says, I've discovered that my goats like to eat the moss on the roof. Another reason that goats make the best pets.
Oh, wow. Goats on the roof. I got to see this. Take a picture.
Yeah, take a picture, Mary Jo, and you can post it to our weekday Facebook page or send it to weekday@kuow.org. We go to Jade now in Seattle. Hi, Jade.
We bought a house that was built in 1963, and we are gutting the bathroom, and it does have a blue porcelain bathtub that we want to see if we could resurface that rather than pulling it out. And how effective would this be? And is it worth, I think it's about $500, our quotes that came through.
Right, right. Well, sometimes there's a really antique clawfoot tub that might be worth pulling out and sending to a place that can completely restore it. Those are, you know, kind of valuable. The more typical bathtub, but steel with a porcelain finish, can be refinished in place for a certain amount of money, but you have to be very gentle with that surface in the future because it's a kind of a thin surface treatment that, you know, you have to be very careful about how you clean it and so forth, and you shouldn't expect it to last forever. It's not like the original glass porcelain in the case of, you know, in-home restoration. It's, you know, they work pretty well, but I've seen them fail, you know, where it comes off in sheets. And so that's disappointing. So don't expect it to be as durable as the original if you do get it redone.
So it may be more cost effective just to pull it out and spend $500 for a white tub.
Yeah.
Well, maybe, although, you know, when you pull something out, there's one thing leads to another. You know how it becomes a whole bathroom remodel because, you know, the tile work goes over the lip of the tub, and so you start tearing things apart and then find. So it's best to have another bathroom to retreat to. I hope you have a second bathroom somewhere.
Okay.
And so that, you know, if the project grows, you won't be so unhappy.
Okay.
Right.
And
thank you.
And, yeah, just kind of get fully prepared, and good luck.
Thanks for that call, Jade. We're talking for a little while more with Roger Ferris. So many questions. It's always the problem with a house.
It's so fun. And thank you to the caller who wrote in saying, be careful with a pressure washer on the roof. I would not use a pressure washer up there. It could do too much damage.
Damage on your roof. And you never know. My husband fell off a roof and broke his pelvis. So always be careful on the roof.
You're so right. That is probably the most common way for people to get hurt is on a ladder or fiddling around on the roof. I know many people who've been in serious trouble. You know.
Yeah, at Harborview, they call summer the home repair season, the trauma season.
Yeah.
We go to Judith now. She's in Columbia City. Hi, Judith.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, go ahead, Judith.
We pulled up the carpet in our living room, and we're disappointed to find it wasn't hardwood. It was fur, and what's more, it wasn't the long grain fur, whatever. We've got different advice from flooring people. One said, yes, he could refinish it. It wouldn't last forever, but the finish would kind of hold it together. And a couple others said, no, there's no point doing that. No, you should just replace it, put in oak. But our house is kind of a cottage, and oak seems like a real stretch.
Well, you know, it's a matter of taste, but the fir floors are so warm, the color is so beautiful, I really prefer them to look at, you know, over oak. I just think they're gorgeous. And when they're refinished, they're just so nice. And then, you know, you also have to remember that, you know, we all should be just kicking off our shoes when we come in the front door because you track in so much stuff and grit and bad things. So they'll stay very nice for a very long time if people, most of the time, you know, remove their shoes when they come in the house. And then, you know, it's a lot cheaper to refinish the floor than to replace the floor. So I would very much consider enjoying the warmth and beauty of a fir floor.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Good luck, Judith. Thanks for calling. We've got a bunch of people emailing in with a general questions about appliance replacement. Beth, I'll read Beth's because it's typical of many of them. I'm so glad you're back, Roger. My house with its toilets and appliances is 22 years old. Everything works well with a flapper replaced here and there.
Yeah.
My refrigerator, washer, dryer, and dishwasher are 15 to 18 years old. Do you think it's better for the environment to replace things with more efficient appliances or to use them until they're completely dead before you replace them? And if you're going to replace them, where do you look for the best type of appliance?
Yeah, well, I tend to use things until they're just gone, you know, until they've really worn out, which means sometimes I get a lot of mileage out of the thing. It's amazing how long some things can last, even though, you know, way beyond their expected lifespan, which is kind of satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
But it's true that some of these old appliances that I continue to use are not energy efficient. So, you know, where is the trade-off? You know, sometimes there's even a rebate program to encourage us to get more efficient appliances so we don't waste so much power. And I haven't studied it enough to know what the magic sweet spot is, but it's certainly worth thinking about. And, you know, I kind of like the idea of not trying to do everything at once, because you can probably make better decisions if you...
If you're not doing a clean sweep of your entire house.
Right.
Most of us can't afford to do that.
Yeah. And then, you know, sometimes there's a sort of unpleasant surprise about a new energy efficient unit. Like, I've had a number of people really complain to me that their water-saving, energy-efficient clothes washing machines don't smell very good, because there's something about the front-loading machines that a little water sits in there, apparently, and they don't, I don't know why, they don't drain completely, and then that water gets kind of foul. And so people end up having to figure out some sort of baking soda solution or whatever. But, you know, not everything about new stuff is perfect.
No.
The big downside, of course, is the cost. You know, some of these really nice, high-quality, energy-saving things cost a lot up front. So it's a little daunting for me sometimes to look at the price tag. But sorry, I don't have a very good answer about when to make that decision. But because there's so many factors.
Is there some kind of publication or website that you might refer people to when we're just thinking about perusing the options for energy efficient appliances?
Yeah, you know, I think it does make sense to read what's out there in you know, on the internet. There are a lot of reviews of different appliances, and sometimes you learn something about an appliance that turns out to be all too true. You know, bitter complaints often have a basis. Not always. Sometimes it's someone who's just grumpy. But it's funny, I did that. I wanted a certain refrigerator to replace the old one that had died, and I was willing to go with a kind of an odd brand, even though there were complaints in the reviews. And sure enough, you know, there were some odd things about it. But this was an odd size that would fit, and it would set back, and it was smaller, and it's the only one I could find. But it turned out to have some downside. And in fact, I had to get them to replace it, you know, because it just wasn't right the first time.
So pay attention
and
to those reviews.
Painful. Yeah, I think so.
I want to quickly squeeze in. Jeff says he's a bryophytic ecologist. He studies mosses.
Oh.
Non-vascular plants like moss don't have roots. So
right.
Those aren't going to wreck your shingles. I think you said that, Roger. Second, Florence wants to take you up on the H thing. So when you go to Hawaii, what's the ideal thermostat temperature?
Oh, for your house. Well, that's a good question, because if you put it down too low, then you might have your pipes freeze and break. So the ideal thing is to put the temperature down fairly low in the 50s, but have a neighbor who knows that if we get down into the teens or lower for temperature, that they should come over, open the door, and turn the heat back up a little bit to make sure that your pipes are okay.
And I hope you enjoy Hawaii there. And lastly, in British Columbia, there's a town with a restaurant called Goats on the Roof, and they really have them, says Bob. Yeah. So we'll all go check it out, Roger.
My insurance company probably wouldn't allow that.
No, but they don't like the moss either, so maybe you could flip them a coin. Which do you like worse?
Yeah, yeah.
Roger Ferris is the home repair guru, director emeritus of Finney Neighborhood Center's Well Home Program, working with FEMA on hazard mitigation. Nice to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Marcy.
And now, the sound of the day. Well, birds, obviously that sound comes to us from Nicaragua. Those are birds singing in a tree around sunset in the northern coffee region of San Ramon, Nicaragua. Let's hear a little more. These are birds. Our weekday listener, Jeremy, has been living in Nicaragua for the past 6 years. He says he often hears birds making noise at sunset, but this time they seemed especially active and loud, so he taped them. We don't know what kind of birds they are, but definitely not robins, I think. What interesting sounds are you listening to? We'd love you to record 30 seconds and send those sounds to us along with the story behind them. You can email your sound file to weekday@kuow.org. Write sound of the day in the subject line, and there's lots of days in every year, and so we want lots of sounds. This is Wednesday, and that means coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to talk to our regular Wednesday guest, Vaughn Palmer, news from Canada. Canada has just created an Office of Religious Freedom. We're going to hear what that is and who is running that office. We're also going to have our Geek Wire editor, Todd Bishop, in, and the centenary of many cinematic luminaries is this year. Robert Horton will have details on that and more. That's coming up in the next hour on Weekday, so I hope you can stay with us.
Ten a.m. Secretary of State John Kerry on talks with Iran in the news in a moment.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.